Welcome to Community Conversations, a monthly program on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson, and this evening we're talking about some ideas that are fresh on the minds of many college students, parents, and professors. A recent article in The Atlantic titled "The Coddling of the American Mind" says, quote, "In the name of emotional well-being, college students are increasingly demanding protection from words and ideas they don't like." Authors Greg Lukianoff, a constitutional lawyer who defends free speech and academic freedom on campus, and Jonathan Haidt, a social psychologist, maintain this practice is, quote, "disastrous for education and mental health," unquote. Shane Cortland is a philosophy professor at UMD and the director of UMD's Center for Ethics and Public Policy. He says the center's goal is to assemble people who are passionate about important issues in the community, frequently who hold points of view that normally disagree with one another, and have them share their experience and positions. And that, says Cortland, accomplishes what he sees as one of the primary obligations of a university, to force you to look at another point of view different from your own. But Cortland says it's becoming increasingly more complicated in universities across the country to accomplish that goal in the classroom. In July, he was part of an invitation-only educational seminar in Washington, D.C. on the topic of academic freedom. The program consisted of workshops and Socratic-style discussions that highlighted the importance of free speech on campus. In fact, one of the speakers was also the co-author of that article in The Atlantic. Here's Shane Cortland.
The conference was actually on academic freedom, right, or academic liberty is another way, I guess, of saying it. And was run by IHS, which is the Institute for Humane Studies. And the Center for Ethics and Public Policy has done work with them before. And it was largely about talking about what actually is academic freedom and talking about also various ways in which it is challenged, right? So we had a few speakers that came to it. One of them was a recently retired professor from UW-Madison, Donald Downs, right, who had various issues with speech codes at UW-Madison in the late, I think, 80s and early 90s. And he, of course, successfully rebutted those codes. We also had, I believe his name was Greg Lukianoff, who is the head of FIRE, right, which, if I get the acronym correctly here, it's Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Right, and they recently just won a lawsuit for $900,000 against Valdosta State University, specifically defending the rights of a student against the president of that university. And then John Tomasi, who is the head of the Brown Political Project, Political Theory Project at Brown University, who recently they were in the New York Times because they had invited a couple philosophers, or not necessarily philosophers, a couple, one was an economist, I believe, to talk about, you know, rape culture and whether or not that was even appropriate to talk about rape culture anymore. And some students were a little bit incensed that these people were invited, and so they created what's referred to as a safe room where they can go into and play with Play-Doh and bubbles and so forth. And a lot of people thought that on the, you know, just the very notion of the university, that this was somewhat inappropriate, that they were doing so to avoid scary ideas. Right, where university is a place in which you're supposed to encounter such ideas, you know, and find, you know, ways to understand it and, of course, just to develop knowledge, right? So he'd like to point out that, you know, he was trying to advocate unsafe spaces because what that meant was is that you were encountering ideas that were different than yours.
As a native Minnesotan, mm-hmm. I have always equated political correctness, in air quotes, with Minnesota nice. You don't use certain words, you don't talk about things in a certain way because yes. They're hurtful to people. But I'm realizing that it's a lot more complicated than that. We're moving toward not just considerate speech, we are moving toward prohibited speech. You referenced earlier speech codes.
Yes.
Can you give us some examples of that?
Various places. Madison was one of them, obviously, right? But it goes across. And I'd encourage, you know, any of the listeners to check out FIRE's website, thefire.org. right? Because they actually will rate various speech codes, right? And they, some of them as being, you know, constitutionally unacceptable and so forth. But the general idea is that many of these codes are put into place that limit, they'll call it either harassment speech, right? Or speech that encourages bias, right? And the problematic nature of such codes generally is that, one, if they're always going to tend to miss something that will insult or offend somebody, right? So in order to kind of catch all of it, right, they will tend to make such codes vague, right? But of course, by making such codes vague, all of a sudden a lot gets prohibited.
Or a lot is open to interpretation.
Very much so. And the thing with, you know, various sorts of discriminatory speech and so forth, a lot of it is. A lot of it depends on context, right? So if I were to, say, use the N-word, and then you were like, well, that's radically inappropriate. And I'm like, but I'm talking about Huck Finn, right? And you're like, well, the context changes, right? You know, and so context really matters a lot, not to mention intention, right? And so the concern with such codes is that they can be, you know, overly prohibitive. And moreover, the other sort of issue with such things, it's, you're right, civility is incredibly important. And, you know, being PC in a sense, in some sense, embraces this sort of civility. And being Minnesota Nice, for example, embraces this civility. The problem, and you pointed out to it, and I think it's quite right, it's not so much just being civil, it's mandating civility, right? And using sort of the tools of power to say what you can and cannot say. And it may not be appropriate, right? In fact, I would say it's probably not, especially in an academic atmosphere, right? These sorts of things, of course, you can criticize people for being uncivil, but to try to force so by, say, policy is going to lead us to some problems.
It seemed to me to make fairly good sense to take down a Confederate flag, mm-hmm. or even the Ten Commandments from a public courthouse. These are supposed to be, sure, places where everyone can come and feel as though their interests are going to be represented fairly. A university, above all, is a place to explore different kinds of ideas. The rules for a university, in a sense, need to be more liberal, mm-hmm. and yet in another sense, as we've seen here on this very campus, there are a lot of rules, regulations, suggestions, yes, to make it a welcoming and make people feel safe. So how do, yes, those two things work together?
Sometimes not very well. And this is not to say that we ought not to try to make people feel comfortable. But we have to also realize that there's a certain inherent thing, specifically within education, that makes people feel uncomfortable, right? And in order to do education right, there has to be a certain level of, how would you say, lack of comfort that has to be maintained, right? And that's just, you know, in the very nature of encountering ideas that are different from your own, right? And there is no other way to be educated than that, right, is to encounter diversity. And so one of the concerns that at least I've seen a lot, and I think was also mentioned at this particular conference, was that, you know, diversity is noted, and it is very important, but intellectual diversity often is not, right? Diversity in ideas, right, is sometimes pushed aside, and there are certain sorts of dominant ideas. So take, for example, people who are not a fan of, say, same-sex marriage, right? What you'll find, I think, on many contemporary universities, right, is that these ideas will be shouted down, right? Now, I by no means endorse such ideas, but as far as a sort of, you know, method of education, they need to be brought up, right? And if these ideas are unpopular, more so they need to be discussed, right? But as soon as anybody tries to discuss such ideas, there is a sort of concern that they'll be painted as a homophobe, for example, right? And so in a certain sense, I admit it has to be done delicately, but it can't be prohibited, right? Moreover, you can't have various sorts of campaigns for unpopular ideas to try to shut people down. You know, as some people refer to it as a sort of thought vigilantism, right? You know, where all of a sudden they're like, oh, you have an unpopular idea. We realize that we can't make what you say illegal, but we will organize campaigns against you, right? And this is a concern, I think, you know, in an academic setting. Because, you know, in an academic setting, it used to be the case where people, when they're talking about academic freedom, it was pretty obvious who was assaulting it, right? And so you think in the era of, like, say, McCarthyism, right? You know, or the government, you know, kind of saying, oh, this is an unpopular idea. It challenges the government's authority. You know, when it's coming from without, right, it's really, really sort of obvious. Now, nowadays, it's different in the sense that it seems that things that challenge such sorts of freedoms are from within the institution itself, right? There are various sorts of ideas that the institution, you know, tries to avoid. And these ideas, you know, often have to do with various sorts of groups that have been discriminated against in the past or stigmatized, right? And in order to ensure that, you know, they feel comfortable, sometimes speech is curtailed, right? Or the expression of certain ideas is curtailed. And that's nervous. But there's no really, how would you say, smoking gun or silver bullet or whatever to the extent to say that we can find some cheap and easy solution to this.
In a sense, what I hear you saying is that there are groups that have been discriminated against, that have been in the minority, that have been victimized. The points of view that perhaps resulted in that original discrimination, the original victimization, also have a place at the table as part of an intellectual discussion, even if they're only there so that perhaps you could learn about them and reject that kind of thinking. The question then becomes for you as an educator, how do I bring those points of view back? How do I bring those points of view into a discussion without re-victimizing somebody? How do you reconcile creating a safe place for people, plus maybe talking about some of the ideas that threaten them, perhaps, to begin with?
This is what's a little bit nerve-wracking, at least as an educator. I mean, initially, when these trigger warnings came out, a lot of it had to do, say, with people who had been victimized, say, via rape, right? And you might see a sign or a particular sort of scene that would, say, dramatize rape, and this could trigger something, right? Rightfully so. And so people would set out these trigger warnings. Now, a lot of professors that we've been seeing have been pushed to a certain extent that if you're dealing with certain material, to add trigger warnings in. And it becomes more sort of expansive. But then the question, of course, is that, you know, this is definitely a mental health concern. But, you know, are the vast majority of our students suffering from mental health issues to this degree, right? This seems to be maybe, say, going a little bit overboard and treating it a little bit excessively. The other thing about microaggressions, which kind of ties in here, is that some things, just portraying them, seem to be so, people will take them offensively even though they're not overtly so. So you could say that if somebody made the claim that, you know, hey, you look different. Oh, that's a microaggression. You're referring to my race. I'm insulted by that, so on and so forth, right? And so these sort of things have made it even, how would you say, grayer and muddied the waters even more so, to the point where a lot of people are questioning if they have a role in academia, right? A legitimate role. And the concern is that, you know, education, in some sense, causes some suffering, and that can't be avoided. And the concern about constantly making the safe place where people are not feeling insulted, that seems to undermine the very enterprise of education. Now, a lot of times people will say, well, look, these are damaging words. The question is that being overplayed?
Shane Cortland is a philosophy professor here at UMD and the director of its Center for Ethics and Public Policy. In July, he was part of an invitation-only educational seminar in Washington, D.C. on the topic of academic freedom.
And here's the thing. I don't want to infantilize my students, right, by saying that, you know, oh, we just got to assume that they can't take these kind of words, right, or take these kind of ideas. You know, we will treat them like children. And I don't think that, you know, one, I don't think they are. I think they're actually capable of taking a lot more. Right. And two, I think that's a horrible sort of pedagogical move to make. Right. Because if I keep infantilizing them and just saying you can't take it, chances are they'll never encounter these views. Right. At least not in my classroom, and they'll never learn. Right. So my sort of concern with this is that they avoid ideas that are uncomfortable. Right. And by avoiding ideas that are uncomfortable, they then never get challenged. And if they're never challenged, they never learn. Right. I had a former professor of mine. Right. He happens to be on the sort of right side of the political spectrum. When I mean right side, I mean the opposite of the left side. Right. So he was telling me that, you know, one of the hardest things about college is that you'll find, especially in today's college, right, college setting, you find that a lot of conservative students get a better education than liberal students. The reason this is so right, is that conservative students are constantly being challenged. Their ideas are challenged because it tends to be that a lot of professors nowadays tend to be on the left side of the political spectrum. And because they're on the left side of the political spectrum, right, they are constantly challenging conservative students, constantly. And this provides the conservative students a better education, right? It's uncomfortable. You know, they don't usually like it. But on the other hand, the disservice that is sometimes done is to the liberal students who are not so challenged, right? Now, my goal is just to make sure everybody is equally so challenged within college, right? They need to encounter difficult ideas, right? Now, without a doubt, this has to be done very sensitively because some of these ideas, you know, can cause a lot of, you know, say, emotional strife and so forth. And I don't want to belittle that. But nonetheless, creating a policy to prevent such things from happening, I think, is foolhardy in an educational setting.
Let me ask you something that may be going down a path that has nothing to do with the path that we will eventually go down. But one of the things that has struck me, although I don't know if I'll be able to articulate it clearly, mm-hmm. about the difference between a conservative and a liberal ideology is that the liberal ideology says, I'll make up my own mind about what is right for me. The conservative ideology says, I will make up my own mind about what is right for me, and if it's right for me, it should also be right for you. Is that accurate?
Well, it's complicated. So in the United States, conservative and liberal doesn't necessarily track what people mean by conservative and liberal, say, in political theory and so forth, right? So if you look at, say, Republicans, for example, just painting with a very broad brush here, Republicans want to say, well, look, government shouldn't tell you, right, what you should do with your money, right? So taxation's a bad idea, you know, centralized government kind of makes them a little scared. But on the other hand, when it comes to, say, various sort of social issues like morality and so forth, they very much want control over you. So like, say, you know, they don't want to give you, as, you know, liberals would point out, freedom of choice when it comes to what to do with your body, right, in these particular situations. Liberals, usually how they're done in the United States, in a certain sense, they say, government, stay out of social issues, right? You know, let's give a wide sort of berth so you get to decide, for example, whether or not it's abortion's right for you or not, right? But then again, when it comes to what to do with your money, they very much are comfortable letting the government take your money and do what the government feels is right to do with it. So there's this weird sort of divide. Now, libertarianism, you know, what they want to do is they just say, we don't want anybody telling you what to do ever, right? So ultimately, government then can't say, you know, what to do with your money, right? You know, you do it. And in that sense, they're fiscally conservative. But they're socially liberal in the sense they also say the government can't tell you how you ought to live, right? And they ought not to mandate that either, right? So what I'm usually meaning here, it's kind of a blurred line. So it's hard for me to pigeonhole and say that person is a liberal or that person, you know, is a conservative in this sort of regard, because it depends on what their particular view is.
And that's really an excellent point to make, because it is a little harder to push back against somebody who says, this is what, you know, my reality, this is what I want to do, you do whatever's right for you.
Yeah.
It's hard to push back against them, but somebody says, no, it's not only right for me, but it's going to be right for you too, and it needs to be the law of the land, so everybody does it my way. That's really easy to push back against.
Yes.
And that was kind of what I was wondering, if with some of the, you know, this idea of being really uber liberal on campus, if there just isn't, because of maybe some intrinsic thing about liberalism, there just isn't something to push back against. But I see your point. It sure is. It's just something different. You just look for it in a different spot.
Well, so the big sort of concern here, like, say, their speech codes or so forth, it's not so much that there is this push to be civil, even right. It's the fact that they want to have it backed up by a code that is often punishable. Right. So it's one thing to say that, you know, in good company, you ought not to speak thus and so. Right. It's another thing to say that, oh, yeah. And if you do. Right. You know, we are going to decide to either kick you out of here. We are going to, say, take away your job. We are going to make your life sort of a living hell, for lack of a better term. That is where you start seeing the sort of coercive element of it in the background, which has a chilling effect. Right. You know,
now, when we talk about speech codes, let me interrupt. Are we talking about these codes in effect for faculty, staff, and students?
It depends on the institution.
Or just faculty?
It depends on the institution.
Okay.
So, like, when I talked to you before about Donald Downs and UW-Madison, they had one for the students and they had one for the faculty. And the funny thing about it was is they had forgotten about the faculty code and fought the student code until somebody politely reminded them that there's this really nasty code for the faculty as well. And so these things vary, you know, with all different sorts of institutions, right? You know, depending on the institution, they may have various different codes. And some of these codes are okay, right? You know, some of these codes don't run afoul of any sort of, you know, constitutional rights that people have. Other codes, it's questionable, right?
In some instances, bouncing around a little bit, but in some instances, for example, a student who may have felt marginalized and discounted because of a rape, or a student who may have felt marginalized or discounted because of their race, or their political ideology, for that matter, that student has already encountered a lot of pushback. That student may really be kind of traumatized by the pushback that they've gotten. So from that standpoint, you do kind of worry about, if you are a person with compassion, you do kind of worry about re-victimizing that person. Is there a way of getting up in front of class at the beginning of the semester and saying, we're going to talk about all kinds of ideas here. Some of them are going to be antithetical to everything you are and believe, but we've got to talk about them so that you understand both sides, or you understand the nuance of the situation.
Of course, of course. So when I'm saying that I advocate this sort of free discussion of ideas that many people find offensive, I don't mean to do so heavy-handedly, right? It has to be very delicate. And I find myself, you know, as a teacher here, you know, constantly trying to tell people, be prepared, right? You know, we are going to talk about things that are going to make you feel very uncomfortable. But it is a requirement of education that these things be discussed, right? It is required. And as soon as these things are prohibited, we're no longer teaching so much as we're indoctrinating, right? And even if you agree that we're indoctrinating them with the right views, right? It's still not education, because education, you know, fundamentally, I think even as a concept, requires the diversity in ideas be presented, right? Even if these ideas are unpopular, horrible, whatever, right? They need to be discussed. So, you know, and I always get challenged, and I think many other people in the academy get challenged as well, you know, as to what separates indoctrination from education, and it is precisely the presentation of diverse viewpoints, right? And as soon as that's taken away, it kind of takes away the high ground from anything in academia, right? And so it's kind of misguided, I would say, then, to protect people to such a degree that these ideas are prevented from getting to them, right? From them being exposed to them. So without a doubt, you do so delicately, right? Because you're not trying to be, I mean, this is just part of being civil and polite, right? You know, you want to present these ideas to them in a way that, you know, they're not going to feel unduly stressed by it. But then again, you have to also realize that your end goal is not their comfort. Your end goal is education.
Shane Courtland is a philosophy professor here at UMD and the director of its Center for Ethics and Public Policy. In July, he was part of an invitation-only educational seminar in Washington, D.C. on the topic of academic freedom. How important is the idea of teaching students that, for example, we can have a conversation about what white people have done historically that isn't about you personally? How important is it for students to be able to learn to talk about ideas and look at things at a remove so that it isn't all about, you know, me?
Yes.
It's about things that happen outside of me and look at it from that remove. How important is that?
Ridiculously important. It's kind of like the sort of decentering, right? You know, so there's a chance for people, especially when they're very young, right, to always view it with this sort of lens, you know, how it impacts me, how it touches me, and so forth. And I think a little way of maturity and development is when people are able to sort of decentral it from themselves. So it's no longer them. It's not about them so much as these sort of abstract concepts. Right. And, you know, and this may be partly because of, you know, what my trade is and that I'm a philosopher in this regard. You know, usually the best philosophy, the way that I usually conduct it, is this ability to cut it off from yourself and look at these ideas. Now, that being said, hard to do, really, really hard to do, but an incredibly important important skill. The problem, I think, with a lot of these sort of policies, if we forbid having these sorts of discussions, they will not develop this skill in college. And when they leave, when they go outside of the university, when they're outside of academia, the world is not going to be so civil. And they will not have the tools to deal with these things. So in a certain sense, we're able to present these dangerous ideas in a place that is much safer than anything in the outside world and allows them to tackle with it. If we treat them with kid gloves the whole way through this institution, they are not going to be prepared for the real world that is not so kind.
Don Shelby told me once in an interview with him that even on social media, he doesn't pay attention to what the people say who agree with him. He pays attention to what the people say who don't agree with him, because he understands why people think the way he does. He doesn't understand a lot of things about why people who feel differently, why they feel that way. Yep. And his sense is, as he has moved from a journalist to an advocate, if my goal as an advocate is to change people's minds, I can't do that unless I understand what it is that they are reacting to.
Yes, that is ridiculously praiseworthy. The reason it's so praiseworthy is that the vast majority of people in this world do not do what you just said. They feel much more comfortable in echo chambers. So they will only, in today's modern media just helps that too. So you can find various news outlets and TV channels and various literature that caters to your particular prejudice. It is a more pleasant experience for people using Facebook to only encounter their own views. And so this is one of the reasons why I'm a little bit scared in college settings, is because this is a sort of human nature thing that when people come to college, it's going to be comfortable for them to only encounter their own views. But education is exactly sort of opposed to that. We need to get people to encounter views that are different from theirs, and it will necessarily make them feel uncomfortable. John Stuart Mill, in 1859, writes this piece that is ridiculously influential. It's called On Liberty. And in there, he has probably one of the most famous arguments for free speech. And the argument is really straightforward. So he says, look, the person that you want to limit their speech, they may be saying something true. And if they're saying something true, you ought to let them say it because we benefit by this. We learn something from this. Now, the person that you're listening to may be saying something false. We still benefit from listening to it. And the reason we benefit from listening to it is that we then know better why we have the view that we have. And the way you ensure that you're not just purporting another dogma, even a true one, is that you encounter people with a different view. You gain everything by encountering these diverse viewpoints. Everything. And you don't lose anything except maybe a little bit of comfort. But given the ultimate goal, whether it be in an educational setting or just being a learned individual, it's worth it. It's worth it to have this sort of uncomfortable feeling.
You've encountered some pushback on this idea. And I guess if I were in one of those groups, my way of expressing my point of view would be to say, look, I've already had the pushback. I've already been discriminated against.
Sure.
I've already been the victim of hate speech. And now you want to bring up the things that people think and say about me. And you want to put that into part of a curriculum. And if society is trying to move in a way where the point is that people don't talk to me this way anymore, why do I need to sit through it in a classroom?
It is okay to challenge these viewpoints. I recommend challenging these viewpoints. They ought to be challenged. But the problem is prohibiting the expression of such viewpoints. I want this sort of constant challenging of these views and brought out into the sun, you know, and so people can actually see them for what they are. So in a certain sense, I don't consider myself to be, how would you say, against these particular proponents who are pushing back against me. I just feel that, you know, as a procedure, it's not helpful. The best way to, say, put these things down is to have them expressed and then have people counter them openly right away.
Community Conversations is a monthly program here on KUMD dedicated to topics of interest in our community and fostering our community connections. I'm your host, Lisa Johnson. Our guest this evening was Shane Cortland, a philosophy professor here at UMD and the director of its Center for Ethics and Public Policy. In July, he was part of an invitation-only educational seminar in Washington, D.C. on the topic of academic freedom. For more information on this topic, we have links set up on our website to the article in The Atlantic titled The Coddling of the American Mind and to the website Shane mentioned, FIRE, the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. The FIRE website does not list a speech code for the University of Minnesota Duluth, but it does for the University of Minnesota in the Twin Cities. You can find that link also on our site at kumd.org/programs/community conversations. Community Conversations is produced at KUMD by Lisa Johnson and is funded by the Minnesota Arts and Cultural Heritage Fund.